Dave, thank you for that. Thank you for your leadership in the communities from which you hail, and for coming together in a very impressive assortment. You ought to see yourselves from here. I'm an optimist by nature, but when I look at this assembled candle power, I don't have the slightest doubt that rural Indiana is on its way back, and we're going to come all the way back. I want to just share a few thoughts with you this morning about why I think that and why it's essential that we all make work together to make it come true. I am an optimist. I don't know any other operating philosophy that works very well in life. But I'm sincerely optimistic, as not everybody is, about the future of rural Indiana, rural America generally. Some of the things we've been doing here are perhaps unusual commitment to this. A whole area of our responsibility has attracted the attention of folks elsewhere. I get invitations all the time coming out of state to talk about what we're doing in rural Indiana, what we're doing about agriculture, agribusiness, and so forth. And I accept very, very few of those because I want to stay here and tend to knitting. But when I do go, or when I'm asked that question by someone elsewhere, I start by telling them, don't you worry about us. Rural Indiana, we grow them pretty sturdy out here. And I tell them about, of course, I've met thousands of people out there rattling around now for several years. But many of my favorite memories sort of remind me of the resilience of our people and the land they live on. One night I was down at a little place called Sanborn, just down toward Vincennes, and we stopped for gas, I guess it was. And the only place in Sanborn is just a little corner. And there's a couple old fellas out there commuting, a little gazebo, and I went over to say hello. One great big guy, he's older, but he's still big. Stood up straight, he's wearing bib overalls. Savvy traveler that I am, I said, why, are you in agriculture? He said, oh yes, all my life. And I said, well, how much you farm? He said, it was 800 acres, something fairly significant. I said, oh, noting he was, up there. I said, well, that's a lot. It's a lot of work. I said, is it a family place? Yeah. I said, so, maybe does your son really help you out? And he said, oh, well, he used to, but he got too old. He ain't much use anymore. Now my grandson helps me. I said, well, Jim, how old are you? He said, 92. And then my favorite story, I get emails almost nightly now from a church mate whose grandmother is Bertha Fry, a farm girl. I still think of her that way. Who's living up at Muncie, grew up not far from there. And you may have read about Bertha because she is the second oldest person on the planet today. And she is 113. The first oldest person on the planet is Edna Parker. She lives down by Shelbyville. These are my two girlfriends. Well, two out of three. And we got them together, actually, on Edna's 114th birthday. And some guy, by the way, I rode my motorcycle down there. It was a Saturday. And just as I'm getting off, here comes some somewhat nerdy-looking fellow. He was from the Guinness Book of World Records. And he was there with a little plaque to commemorate that this is the oldest combined age of any two people who ever met in the history of the Earth. 227 years and change. And right here in Indiana, both, I said, what was the secret? He said, I don't know, lard. Before I get off this, I have to share with you, because, as we all get older, from time to time you get to feel a little long in the tooth. I'll make you feel better. And I went up to see Bertha back around New Year's, and some fellow from the local radio station came over. He thought this was all very interesting. And I heard him ask her, what she remembered from that long life, all the history she'd lived through, and she named two or three things, and she said, and the assassination, of course, the assassination of the president. This guy says, yes, well, everyone alive at the time remembers exactly where they were when President Kennedy was shot. She said, no, young man, McKinley. 7 years old when President McKinley was shot. So if you get to be feeling a little geriatric, you got lots of time. I'm here to confess a bias. Confession's supposed to be good for the soul. We're supposed to free ourselves of our prejudices. I have a prejudice I don't expect to get free of. We have a small town bias in our administration. We have a bias in favor of the rural spaces of this state. And we are doing those things we can do to foster what I believe can be a great revival in rural Indiana. And I trust you have somewhat the same spirit about this. You wouldn't have chosen the walks of life you have. And I want to say that this prejudice of ours, mine, my partner Becky Skillman, and those who we have gathered around us for this purpose, this is not sentimental. This is not an affair of the heart. Oh, yes, it is. Like about every Hoosier I meet, we love rural Indiana. And the history that's there, the tradition, the people, the values. And that's always going to be a big part, I hope, of our self-identification as a state. But that's not where our commitment comes from. No, folks, this is business. And I didn't come to this intellectual part of this commitment lightly. I have been traveling this state with an emphasis, frankly, on the smaller towns and the rural places. I have spent the night now in close to 100 Hoosier homes. Started out as an exercise in cheapness. Became just something we do. Became another great way to learn. Probably 2/3 of those were farm homes or rural, small town places. That's both the way I like it and also the way the calendar tends to fall. I have met with so many, I see so many familiar faces here. With the people who still are operating businesses in our smaller communities, or in some cases have recently chosen that venue. And I really believe that if we take the right steps, the arrows can point up and not down for rural Indiana. We have tried to take those that were most available to us. The nation's most progressive telecom B-Reg bill was a good thing for this whole state. It's triggered already. Hundreds of millions of investment, lots of new jobs. The company said whoever throws their state open to competition will see that, and we have. People are going to see it in falling cable rates in urban as well as rural areas as the competition does what competition does. You watch. But the main reason I was interested in telecom reform is because we wanted the new infrastructure, the 21st century infrastructure, the backbone, economic backbone that we know as broadband, to be available in every corner of the state. And that's not a matter, or not only a matter, of grandma getting, 5,000 channels on demand. It's more a matter of the car dealer whose parts manual is no longer a book. It's online, and it's changing every day. Businesses whose relationships with each other now require that sort of instant communication. And it's happening. Over 100, last count, I think 110 new communities have been hooked up. We're going to get there. We're going to get there faster than we would have. We have taken those steps directly available. The state government. I don't mind who knows it. We do have a bias. Now, we are looking to make state government leaner and cleaner, and we are shrinking it more than we're growing it. There are 5,000 fewer employees in state government than 3 years ago. But where there is an activity of state government, where it requires a facility and a concentration of employment, the standing order in our administration is look for a small town first. First of all, the taxpayer will get a good cost, a good price for a dollar. Secondly, you can't. count on a reliable, stable, hard-working workforce. But most importantly, where we get a chance, anytime we get a chance, to plant a little, even a little, new sprig of economic growth in a smaller town, it means so much more. You swallow it up. You know, the B&B mail center we put in Winchester would have disappeared if we put it in Fort Wayne. And the call center we put in Gas City wouldn't be a blip if it were here in Indianapolis. It means something there, or at least that's what folks in the area tell us. We're trying to send a signal to other employers, or to larger employers, that they ought to look to do these sorts of things too. The IEDC that was referenced earlier is the best mousetrap we've built, I suppose, of all the things we've done. Most of you know, especially those of you who are leaders of economic development organizations yourself, that we found the old bureaucracy lacking, closed that shop up, reopened as a nonprofit business, got some people from business in there to work on it, raised some private money so we could do a few extra things. Records have been falling ever since. This announcement, we missed it 2 days ago. Another huge blockbuster for Indiana. Now, I don't know whether Johnson, Hendricks, or Boone County is going to be home to the new Medco facility, but I know that there are going to be 1,300 and eventually, I predict, far more people employed at very good, family-supporting wages in a variety of jobs. And by the way, a lot of them will choose, you watch, will choose to live in smaller communities where they have all the benefits, quality of life, sense of community that come with small town living or rural living. And that's just the latest in a record-shattering string of those. Well, let me tell you something you probably wouldn't suspect. We went back and counted, seeing this meeting coming, and 49% of all the deals, we've done 435 deals at last count in less than 3 years. Half of them were in communities of 25,000 or smaller. Those employers know now, again, we love to show, we make sure to show them the small town, the mid-sized town option every time, because we hope that's what they'll pick. But it's in their interest to do that, and they know that. Everything I just said a minute ago is well known to the to Honda when they picked Greensboro, just to take a monstrous example. But so many smaller examples, those companies know the same thing. There is so much to be had in the rural spaces and in the towns that anchor them in a state like ours. And so, although it's our job, it's our job to bring new investment, in-source jobs and wealth into this state, get them inside the state line somewhere, then becomes the partnership that we have with you, folks like you, to get them to pick a specific place. But over and over again, they are picking places like those that you come from and represent. And it's an incredible source of joy to me when that happens. When IBM said, I told IBM, if you want this enormous piece of business, help us clean up the worst in American welfare system and save our taxpayers $500 million, well and good. We want some jobs too. They promised 1,000. They were interested, I won't mention names, and some bigger places. I said, how about Daleville? That's where they are. The biofuels explosion that was delayed in Indiana, but is now at full bore. I don't have to tell you this story, but the happiest days, I suppose, that I've had in this job have been going to those groundbreakings, those first gallon roll-offs, and seeing in every single case that this is not only a smaller community or near one, it is the first such investment, the largest such investment in a long, long time. I was out at Linden, I guess, for one of the early ones, and elderly gentleman there, he is Sniffen. And he says it's the first new investment in our town in 45 years of any kind. So, this will be our policy. This will be our bias. And I see real signs of traction and hope. I hope you do too. I hope you will steer us at this meeting and every day to new opportunities, mid-course corrections. You know, if we're naive about things, then straighten us out. If we're overlooking opportunities, open our eyes. But something real and something important is going on here in this state. The new strength in agriculture, don't have to tell anybody in this room, gives us a huge opportunity. You know, Americans, here's another confession, you know, the kind that can get you in trouble, but you know what, don't ask me to be upset about 350 corn or high prices for our crops. Not at today's levels. Americans are the best fed people in the history of the earth, and we spend less of our income to get that way than anybody ever did. Thanks to the American farmer, places like Purdue University, the genius of technology that is making this bounty more and more available, not just to Americans, but to the whole world. And in the long sweep of agriculture, we are in an up, with all its ups and sometimes terrible downs, we are on an upsurge today in terms of farm income and its prospects. And I hope it lasts. I believe it will. And that's a great thing for this whole state. It doesn't happen often, but if somebody in an urban area grumps to me about, you know, price of eggs or price of beef, pork or something, first of all, I try to help them gently, help them understand the corn in that hog is a few cents on the dollar. That's not causing you a problem. And secondly, this is a fabulous thing for Indiana. We are gung-ho for agriculture and agribusiness because of what it can mean to all of rural Indiana. Early this year, I was the keynote speaker at the USDA's biggest annual conference, and the Secretary of Agriculture had called me up, and I tried to duck him, actually, the first time. As I said, I don't go out of state when I can avoid it. We got too much to do. But when I kind of ducked the first time on his letter, he called me up and said, really, I want you to come make this speech. And I said, well, I'm honored, but you know why? You got a whole nation full of people who know more about these subjects than I do. He said, no. He said, in case you didn't know it, when I look around the map, there's almost no state. We got states, even long-time ag states, who are taking neutral to hostile attitudes toward agriculture. As something to be controlled and regulated, fenced off, you know, kept out of view, or out of sniff range, maybe. And he says, but then there's you folks in Indiana, and we just see you moving forward, not just on biofuels, but on livestock production and hardwoods and food processing and these other things that are in the very explicit written strategy we've gotten. So I said, okay, and I went and gave the talk. And I've been getting letters ever since from other places, you know. I said things like, you know, in Indiana, we like hogs. People probably from Illinois and said, well, I wish somebody over here would say that. Again, this is not merely a matter of sentiment, although if you don't have a sense of appreciation and sort of love for the rural heritage of Indiana, then I'm sorry for you. Now, we have that, but this is business, and it's good business for Indiana. And in a world where roads are well built, maintained, and extended, where broadband reaches everywhere, where you can put a business almost anywhere you want on the planet, where you got a chance to get your money back because costs are low, employees are good, workforces are stable. You might just go there. And we know places like that, don't we? You all come from. So, to me, and to Becky, and to David, and I hope to everyone here, we are on offense. If this was ever the whole subject of rural development and rural economic growth was ever a matter of defense and a holding action and delaying the inevitable, that's over in Indiana. We're on the front foot. We believe there's nothing but opportunity there. We've simply got to create the, enhance the conditions that I just mentioned that are already there, go connect them, go show them to people who might not have thought about it yet, and sit back and watch the market work for us. You're doing that every day, I know. You're making our communities more livable. You're organizing for to reach out, show these opportunities to investors who might come here. You are collaborating in better and better ways. This is so important that we not have 92 or 392 separate efforts all operating suboptimally, but that we come together, community to community, across county lines and so forth. These are very positive steps that I see occurring every day I'm out there. And I want to thank you for it, for the successes that are already happening, and for what I think can be an explosion of new success and a rejuvenation of the part of Indiana we love most. Thank you very much. I'd like to take some questions if you'd like to ask them. Otherwise, I'd like to hear about property taxes for a minute. I got all wound up about what I got wound up about, and I skipped over today's topic. Hey, well, let me just give you a quick minute or two on that. It's relevant, I believe, isn't it? So, we've been wrestling with property taxes as a state for a long time. And three times, at least three major occasions, when local property taxes got out of bounds, at least in some places, state government has stepped in. Those of you will remember this. There was 72, there was 82, and there was 02. Half the sales tax you pay now goes back to subsidize local government, civil, school, library, all the rest. And yet, once again, for various historical reasons, not everywhere, but in many places and some places to extreme levels, we've got a problem. So let's go after it. Let's try to learn from history, is my thought. Let's try to do this in a way that really has staying power. I'm very optimistic. I view this as I did product launch in my business days, and you don't know. You can think about it, listen to people, prepare the product as well as you can, but you just don't know until it's out there, whether it's, you know, Windows 1.0 or New Coke. And I think we're off to a really good start. I'm very pleased that both parties in both houses of the General Assembly have indicated not only an openness, but a general agreement with the framework. They're going to use it as the framework. There is no competing plan on offer, at least so far. And there are going to be lots of changes, and there ought to be. There'll be improvements, thank goodness. But I think we can see the outlines of a major, and I hope, more lasting reform that will strengthen our possibilities in rural Indiana. Just to review it quickly, major reductions, on average about a third, in homeowner property taxes. To be accomplished by a penny on the sales tax, remember that business pays almost a quarter of the sales tax and out-of-staters pay a piece. But a penny on the sales tax looked to me like the fairest way to bring down property taxes. And the best way in terms of economics, for sure. The businesses in the towns you represent overwhelmingly are not organized as corporations paying at 8.5. They're organized as partnerships or C-corps or S-corps or in a fashion in which they are paying at our low, flat 3.4%. And I don't want to tinker with that. It's a point of advantage for this state economically when we're trying to bring new jobs in. Okay. By the way, the mechanism I recommended instead of continuing the flow of just subsidizing, sending checks back to local government, the idea, and the commission endorsed it yesterday too, of the state just picking up entire levies, schools, school transportation, child welfare were my recommendation. Take them completely off the property tax burden forever is the way that you would get the reduction I talked about. And when you look to see, you will find, at least in my formulation, small counties come out great. It helps every homeowner everywhere, it helps every county. But particularly if we were to pick up the part of school transportation that the state does not already pay, this is a big relief to less populated counties, right? Permanent caps. 1, 2, 3 was my suggestion. 1 for every homeowner, 2 for rental properties, 3 for other businesses. We could go further. I'd be for that. That's what we could afford at one penny on the sales tax and a little use of the surplus we have painstakingly restored. And from your standpoint, I think it has the following advantages. It makes, first of all, it will make a state where the affordability of housing is already a plus, a big plus. You've all had the experience, haven't you, of talking to somebody who's considering bringing an investment into Indiana, and they almost always are boggled by how affordable housing and other real estate is. We would make it even more so. Now, I got to say this the other way. If we don't act, we're going to give up some of that advantage through these rising property taxes. But if we cut them off, and first cut them and then cap them, we will have a tremendous advantage. Our property taxes will be down in the lowest handful in America on the planet I lay forward. The other thing about caps that I urge you to help us advocate is the certainty that comes with them. The most important thing to business is usually not how much will something cost, but do I have confidence that it will not fluctuate on me? Uncertainty is more damaging to most business than anything else. And here we would have, at last, absolute maximums that you could never be pushed past, either as a homeowner, a dollar, a penny on the dollar, or commercial property owner or business. The commission happened to also endorse, as many others have, reform of the assessment process and local spending controls. And I want to fasten you on that last piece. It will not do to do all these other things and leave spending, local spending, without somebody keeping score. Right now, we've got counties with upwards of 80 taxing districts. Everybody sets the tax where they can get away with it or where they think they need it, uses every loophole and exception they can find. Nobody adds it up, and the total spending keeps rising much faster than Hoosier incomes. That's why people are having trouble affording it. Now, you couldn't run a business that way. You don't run your family that way. We don't run state government that way. So there's a lot of ways this cat could be skinned. We need folks to agree that one way or another, we need a mechanism so that priorities are established. Maybe everybody has to take a little less than they'd like, but at the end of the day, the taxpayer's bill does not go up faster than the taxpayer's income. I see this as a huge opportunity. Everybody knows about the Chinese character. They just had one for crisis and opportunity. Okay, here it is. I think there's huge opportunity here. We got to deal with it. It's a problem. But if we do it in the fashion that I believe we're about to, we can produce very competitive taxes, peace of mind for homeowners, and certainty and clarity for businesses going forward. It'll help us all go market this state to people who ought to come join us and build it. Hope you'll help. Anybody else?
This is Gabriel. Better nationwide of a state trying to gain a competitive advantage by being white for six. What's your opinion on that?
Right.
work as a competitive advantage? What's the Indiana outlook? I do not see that in our future, although what you say is true. I believe we are proving that Indiana can prosper with the labor laws we have now. But it's a legitimate question. There is, and it comes up. But I'm just going to give you a straight answer. We've got so much to do in this state, and so much opportunity, and we're making so much headway, that I don't want to stop all that and have a civil war over something like Brightwood. And that's what it'd be, because there are people very, very passionate on both sides. You know, is it a non-factor? I can't tell you that. You know, our IADC is batting an extraordinary percentage in every chance we get to compete for a piece of work like Medco or Honda or Toyota or Nestle or on and on. These 435. We're winning over 90% where we get a shot. The only problem we got is sometimes we don't get a shot because there are some businesses who use that as a filter and they don't talk to folks who are not right to work states. That's just a fact. I'm not issuing a judgment on it. But I'm just going to give you a direct answer that in full view of that, it is not holding us back today. We have strong partnerships working. And my own sense of this is that we ought to just charge ahead with the great advantages we have. And anytime that becomes an issue, try to manage around it as we have successfully. Straight enough answer? Sure hope everybody could hear that. Should have brought you a microphone. That's very, very kind. It's not necessary. We're only doing what we think makes sense. We're only doing those things we said we thought we'd do. We don't get anything done unless folks like you take leadership and help. And all I'm going to say about that is that I take enormous heart from the positive change and strides I think the state has made. If you agree with that, help us make the next several. Help us spread a sense of optimism among our fellow citizens. You know, a lot of what you see as experts and as activists is not visible to our fellow citizens. We're not visible yet. A lot of the jobs that we've landed are only on their way here now. The plants are just being built, so forth. I'll just close where I began. Optimism is, I think, the best operating philosophy. Not blind optimism, but optimism is based around some sort of plan, and I hope some concrete results. I think we have both those things. And one thing that you can do is be infectious agents of optimism about rural Indiana, about all of Indiana. And where folks are unaware of some of the good things that have happened, let them know. They don't see those opportunities that you see and I see. Help them get a glimpse of a future in which we are leaders, in which we prove that this great revival can occur. And I trained in the Ronald Reagan School, and a lot. It's not just about feeling good. It's about the results that come when people feel a sense of confidence that carries them on to the next challenge and the next opportunity. Thank you very, very much.